It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickers.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll get some reaction to the news we just heard about the passing of South African leader Nelson Mandela. We're working on a guest. I think we'll have somebody in about 10 minutes.
First, the UW System Board of Regents is meeting today to discuss the issue of faculty retention and salaries.
Critics have often said that the UW system is not competing or can't compete with the salaries that other universities offer and sometimes loses its best talent. Here with us to discuss how to retain those professors is former Chancellor of UW-Madison, John Wiley. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you were a former chancellor at UW-Madison. I assume this is not a brand new issue. Has this been a long-running thing, trying to keep talent at the UW?
Oh, it's been a 150-year thing.
Has the situation gotten more competitive, though, among American universities? Is there more poaching and sniping going on?
Well, it's an ongoing thing. I don't know that it's more. I'm told, I did check with our the people who keep our data, and they said we are getting more retention pressure, more outside offers than we usually get, although it's a little bit cyclical. And we've not had an excess of losses. In other words, for the people we really try hard to retain, we usually manage to retain them.
The Regents are meeting today to talk about retention issues. Is there more that they could be doing at UW system institutions? Are we talking about the top tier talent, the middle ranks? Who are they targeting, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I've not been involved with the Regents at all for the last 5 years. I stepped down as chancellor 5 years ago, and I retired completely about 2 years ago. So I'm a little bit out of the loop here. I was a provost of the university for about 5 years and then chancellor for another 8 years. So I have been involved in recruitment and retention issues for a long time and paid very, very close attention to this all the time I was in those positions. But I don't know specifically what the Regents are discussing or considering today. I will tell you that none of the system institutions, no public employees, in fact, no state employees, have had raises for a long time. And so we're well behind where we should be, just not only counting inflation, not counting outside offers.
And how does the UW system usually stack up compared to peer institutions around the country?
Well, Madison usually is a little bit above the middle of the pack. You mean in terms of...
In terms of salary, yeah.
Well, no, actually, I will revise that then. We're a little above the middle of the pack in terms of retention. We're a little below the middle of the pack in terms of salaries, and that varies by professorial level from assistant professor to full professor. Basically, the bottom line is this. We try to maintain an across-the-board star faculty in all positions in all departments. And I say we try, and we often succeed. So our average is above average. Not everyone who gets an outside offer gets a counter offer from us, because there are occasionally some people that we figure we would rather replace with new talent. The ones we try hard to keep, we usually manage to keep. But that is done with private funds and extraordinary effort and significant expense, not at the state expense.
And do you get the sense, or did you get the sense as chancellor, that your hands were ever tied by the state laws, by state regulations on pay and compensation?
No, not really. We have some mechanisms we can use to do base salary adjustments or counter offers. The state's been very reasonable in that respect. They let us counter an outside offer. Unfortunately, once someone gets an outside offer, they've got one foot out the door already. So we try to be preventive and take good care of people that we figure are likely to be rated as best we can. The bottom line is, my constant worry in the last 10 years that I was in administrative positions was not just the superstars, because we can always find a way to keep them or do something that's very competitive and hopefully keep them. it's the average. We can't do the same level of effort for everybody mm-hmm. on the faculty, and we've got very, very good average faculty. Average for us is superstar at many other institutions. And so that was my big worry, that when the general pay plan for the state employees and for the faculty was not competitive, it put extra pressure on us.
How much of it is money in keeping professors around versus other, a good working environment, the political climate? How do those other things factor in your experience?
Oh, no doubt about it. It isn't just money. I will tell you, in my own personal case, I was working in the private sector back in 1974 when I got a job offer at Wisconsin. I was making in that year, now you've got to translate this forward to today's numbers, but I was making about $30,000 a year. And Wisconsin offered me $14,500 for 9 months, for a 9 month pay. And I had to find my own summer salary. So, and I still accepted it because I wanted to work at Wisconsin. So that happens, but you can't count on that. And not everybody is going to make that sacrifice to have a particular kind of career that they think they want.
And all else being equal, maybe another campus has a great working environment, so then the money is a substantial deciding factor.
That's right. That happens sometimes. And when that happens with someone that we really desperately want to keep here, we will move as many mountains as we have to try to keep them here, including raising their salaries and changing their working conditions and so on.
I'm guessing there are some parents out there listening now thinking, I've got a kid at a UW system school, or I'm considering sending a kid there. What does this mean for me? What does this mean for the quality of the education that my child is going to get at the schools, this issue of retaining faculty?
It's something to think about, and we all should, all of us as Wisconsin citizens, should pay attention to the educational environment at all levels, K-12 and higher education. I think we still have an outstanding education system at all levels in the state of Wisconsin on the average. If you've ever played King on the Mountain when you were a kid, it's easier to stay on the top than it is to fight your way back up. And we can lose our competitive position if we're not careful. That's what I worry about also.
Do you ever get the sense that it's overly competitive? There's an arms race among institutions that maybe should be more collegial, or is that just the way things are?
That's just the way things are. I do think that it's overly competitive, but the competition is logical, understandable, and probably justifiable. We pay whatever we need to hire new faculty at the highest level we can find. I mean, the best faculty we can find. And it costs us probably about $1 million to get them from first hire to tenure. So over the next 5 or 6 years, we'll spend about $1 million. And if we lose them at that point, that money is down the drain, and we've got to start over with somebody else and spend another $1 million. So there's a big premium on getting the very best faculty you can and keeping them. And not only that, of the ones that we do get and keep, they pay back our costs in terms of outside money that they bring into the state of Wisconsin in a very short time. So it becomes positive almost immediately after they get to the point of tenure. And that makes it all the more important to fuss and worry about retention issues.
We'll leave it there. John, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You bet.
That's John Wiley, former chancellor at UW-Madison. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking now about the recent death, just heard this in the last hour, about the death of Nelson Mandela, who died at home today. He was 95 years old.
He spent 27 years in prison, led the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, and ultimately became its first black president.
Millions around the world are beginning the mourning process. And here to discuss Mandela's life and legacy is Cyan Loyal, professor of politics at West Virginia University, where her research interests include African politics and transitional justice. Cyan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
First off, what is going through your mind right now with this news that Nelson Mandela has died?
Well, absolutely a great sadness. You know, he was one of the probably most prominent human rights crusaders and leaders of our time, and the world has really lost a special human being today.
What in particular did he mean to Africa?
Well, I mean, Mandela is one of the great crusaders for dignity and equality of all people, and he pursued that agenda independent of race, of class, of political affiliation. And that was really a message, I think, that resonated for people in Africa, but also people globally.
And you talked about what he meant as a crusader to the world. What do you think his prominent legacy will be as people start to look back and think about his many accomplishments over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think his greatest legacy most certainly will be the peaceful transition of South Africa. He fought hard for a peaceful solution, and when he saw that as the best option for the country and its people, he really turned away from violence and was able to negotiate a transition that I think many people wouldn't have been able to do and really averted, I think most people would argue, a civil war in that country.
One of the important things I always wonder about is the peaceful transition for him coming into the presidency, but also a peaceful transition with him leaving the presidency and passing the reins to someone else. How important that is an example to countries going through transitions elsewhere in the world?
Oh, Rob, that's huge. And there are very few leaders in Africa, but even leaders globally that went into power with so much popular support, with so much global support, and then willingly left power. I mean, it calls to mind images of people like George Washington in the U.S. I think it's an important legacy and one that other African leaders should certainly take example of.
His political accomplishments are huge, but something else people point to when they talk about why they love Mandela and why they're inspired by him is his time on Robben Island and how he dealt with those 27 years. Can you talk about what that time was like and how he overcame to a certain extent?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I think anybody would argue that it must be very difficult to spend 27 years in prison, and certainly is the type of experience that's designed to crush someone's spirit. And by all writings and by all evidence, that's not what happened to Mandela. He was actually able to use that time. He did language study, did education. He wrote a lot, and he even developed his political manifesto away from a manifesto of violence to one of political consolidation and negotiation with the white Africans in South Africa at the time. There's been some great films, there's been some great books about that period, and certainly is kind of the stuff of myth or legend.
Maybe it's too soon to be doing this, but is it fair to say that Mandela was one of the greatest political leaders in modern history?
Well, as a student of African politics, I would certainly make that argument. I think his legacy is insurmountable on the continent. For his peaceful transition from power, you know, for actually stepping out of office, but also, again, for being a real global leader, particularly in the South, but all throughout sub-Saharan Africa, both helping negotiate transitions in other countries, negotiate an end to the civil war in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Mandela was very influential in both the political and economic development of the area during his time in office, but also after he left office. He's been a real global statesman ever since.
We'll leave it there for now. Cyan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Cyan Loyal, professor of politics at West Virginia University. She researches African politics.
And just to close, a couple lines from one of Mandela's favorite poems, if I've got my history right. It's called Invictus. And the two that I remember, out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul.
And still checking on this, but I believe we'll have a special on the life of Nelson Mandela coming up here on the Ideas Network after 6. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And most of us can remember the first time we watched Walt Disney's movie Bambi. It's a story of man invading wildlife habitats with development and overhunting.
That was indeed the story of man's relationship with wildlife in America during the 19th and early 20th centuries. Americans overhunted a lot of kinds of wildlife. At the turn of the century, white-tailed deer were nearly extinct.
Our guess says those days are well behind us and that these days we're seeing an overpopulation of animals like deer, raccoons, and even bears and beavers. These animals have crept into suburban and sometimes even urban areas and have increased car accidents and caused damage to property. David Vondrili says the answer is that it's time to cull the herd and expand hunting permits. David's the author of several books. His article, America's Pest Problem, is the cover story of this month's issue of Time magazine. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so 50 years ago, humans had pushed a lot of wildlife to the margins, in some cases to the point of extinction. What is the state right now of suburban and urban wildlife?
There are now more white-tailed deer, for example, living in the United States of America than there were living in that same piece of real estate when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. In other words, even though our population is now over 300 million human beings, deer are doing better than they ever have before. The similar stories can be told about wild pigs, about beavers, about black bears. It's said that there are now probably more mountain lions in the western United States than at any time in the history of the continent. So it's an amazing success story, this change from a nation that worshipped Buffalo Bill, the slaughterer of bison, 100 years ago, to a nation that now lives in closer proximity to more wild animals than probably at any time in our history. But it is beginning to cause some serious problems for humans, but also for the animals themselves.
Well, if you look at the rise of urban wildlife and suburban wildlife, maybe 10 years ago, it was viewed as this new phenomenon that was, it was kind of a cause for celebration, the idea being that humans took over the habitat, annihilated wildlife food sources. But then, look, nature is resilient. They were back. We had hawks and foxes and coyotes in suburbs and cities. Why is that narrative turning on us a little bit now?
Well, because there's even more of them than there were 10 years ago. And as I say, it's a danger not just to us. I mean, it's over a million car accidents with deer, for example, every year, causing $4 billion of repairs, leaving an average of about 200 humans dead every year. But those same accidents leave over a million deer dead every year. You drive down the roads now across the country and you see the carcasses of deers, raccoons, possums, all over the sides of the roads, and even occasionally bears and other large animals that have been killed. We've had cougars that have had to be shot in the middle of the city of Chicago not long ago. Just this week, a woman outside Orlando was mauled by a black bear just outside her house. So these interactions, which I agree with you, they're fantastic. I mean, in my neighborhood of Kansas City, my kids have seen all sorts of wildlife right in their own backyard. But we have created this situation, and now, as difficult as it is for those of us who love animals to face up to it, it's our responsibility to manage the situation in a way that allows us to coexist.
Okay, so you're talking about management there. What does that mean? What are we talking about when we say manage?
It means responsible hunting by, you know, well-trained and licensed hunters, more of it. And, you know, that's tough to say. And since we've published this article, I've heard, you know, some really heartfelt responses from people who, like me, grew up with that Bambi image of the hunter in the woods as a menace to the state of nature. But, you know, those million-plus deer that are being killed by cars every year are just as dead as deer that would be killed by hunters, and it can be done in a way that that creates the right number of animals in relation to what has become a very hospitable human society for wildlife.
Now, if we can get past the image, you know, of killing Bambi, like you talked about, which a lot of people have a knee-jerk reaction against, you know, maybe not necessarily in Wisconsin where there is a lot of hunting, but you're talking about hunting in cities and suburbs. How does that pass muster as something that's going to be a safe alternative?
Well, it has to be. This is why it's important to have, you know, a mature, unsentimental conversation about it, because urban hunting does have the potential to be dangerous. It can't be done without a lot of thought. But in places where they are taking a thoughtful approach, they're proving that it can be done effectively and safely. Generally, it's limited to bow hunters only. In the cases where, and they're required to hunt from elevated stands so that the arrows are pointing downward toward the earth. So if they miss, they end up hitting the ground. In some cases, very highly trained sharpshooters are licensed to hunt in areas that are cleared of human beings to avoid accidents. But this is why we're calling for, you know, an open and, as I say, unsentimental discussion of this problem.
We're talking about how to deal with the huge numbers of wildlife that are now living in urban and suburban areas. We're talking with David Mondrilli, editor-at-large for Time magazine. His article in this month's issue of Time is called America's Pest Problem.
And we'd like to hear your experiences. Have you noticed more deer, raccoons, other animals growing more common in your neck of the woods? Have you seen them in suburban, even urban areas? Do you think we should consider more hunting, as our guest suggests, or other options? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll take your calls after a look at headlines. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back with David Mondrilli talking about his new Time magazine cover story, America's Pest Problem, talking about deer, raccoons, muskrats, a lot of other creatures that a lot of people find are nuisances, especially in suburban, even urban environments. Part of his solution, a cull, hunting carefully in suburban, even city areas.
And we'd love to hear what you think about this. Have you noticed problems with deer, maybe here in Wisconsin, with raccoons, with other animals that may be growing more common? We've been hearing about episodes with bears and issues with maulings in other parts of the state. What do you think is the solution? Do you think that we need to learn to live alongside these new larger populations of wildlife, or is controlled culling the answer? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And David, I want to ask you, what has the creation of the suburbs done to maybe contribute to the problem of these huge wildlife populations?
Well, it's an interesting, complicated story. Initially, if you look at the original suburbs, say Levittown on Long Island, or the Hoffman Heights suburb outside Denver where I was born, what you had was former farmlands and forests clear cut, and lots of little postage stamp houses, planted in row after row after row after row. And this was quite devastating for wildlife in those areas because it was very inhospitable. If you look at the way suburbs are built now, there's all sorts of green space woven through a typical American suburb of today, so that you'll have treed areas and meadow and this kind of a varied geography right alongside the houses. And what this has done is it's been great for the wildlife because it allows them to live in a forest but come right out and do their dining at these fabulous buffets that we plant in our yards, vegetable gardens and flowering trees and fruit trees and these great big delicious cans of yummy garbage that we put out once a week, the succulent grease that we cake on our backyard barbecue grills. We've turned the suburbs into a 24-hour buffet for wildlife, and as a result, there's more of them, but they're also closer to us. So it's both good and bad for the wildlife and for us trying to live with them.
So the living is easy in the suburbs, and that's where they go. All right, well, let's go to the phone lines now. We've got Ryan with us from Menasha. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. Yeah, I was just calling because I know a couple of different areas in Little Chute, Combined Locks, or in those areas, Tacoma. There's actually a very large deer herd in the town area because, and in the city, because there's a little ravine that goes through there, and they know that they're safe in there.
Mm-hmm.
Several people that I know actually have had deer die by drowning in their pools and different areas like that, and like you said, destroying their landscaping and such.
And what do you think about the idea of having hunting, you know, within some of these city and municipal boundaries?
I think it's a great idea. I think there should be some, you know, strict legislation on the, how they do it and the process, but I know that there's ways to do that and to do it safely, and I think that would be a great idea. It would really eliminate some of those problems.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Ryan. Appreciate that. And David, that sounds probably like a typical thing, that deer are just getting into backyards. I don't know if you've heard stories about drowning deer in swimming pools, but clearly
a lot
of deer.
It's the deer in the swimming pool is becoming a pretty frequent story, and so is the deer in the living room. We tell the story in the article about a woman outside Pittsburgh in the suburbs there, 83-year-old woman who heard a crash one morning and went into her hallway to find two adult white-tailed deer coming down the hall toward her. She screamed, slammed the door, you know, activated her emergency medical alert, and by the time the police arrived, they found her plate glass window was, you know, shattered. The adult deer were gone, but there was a terribly frightened fawn trapped in her living room. So it's a complicated matter, and it's traumatizing and difficult for the animals as well as for the humans. And that's the important thing to remember, that this is not just, you know, Bambi and Thumper happy in the woods and people intruding on their lives. It's difficult as well for species that would be living in our neighborhoods if there weren't overpopulation of certain animals. For example, if you have too many white-tailed deer grazing in a woodland, they will eat all of the songbird habitat, and you won't have any songbirds in that woods. Now, nature, without human beings, has ways of controlling these problems, and they are not friendly ways. They involve predators, and they involve starvation. And we have also completely eliminated those problems in the lives of deer and bears and raccoons and all these other animals. We have driven out the apex predators like lions and grizzly bears and wolves because we don't want to live with them in our suburbs. And at the same time, we've provided this overabundance of yummy food for these animals to eat. And so it's not a state of nature out there that humans are somehow intruding on. It's a man-made environment that is creating these overpopulation problems.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Randy is with us next in Marshfield. Hi, Randy.
Hello.
What do you think?
I have an interesting story to talk to you about, but I just want to tell you it has a bad ending. The black bear ended up being shot by the Marshfield Police Department. But to the credit of the Wisconsin DNR and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the agents that worked with me, we tried very hard, and the community tried very hard to remove this bear for two springs. He hibernated under an abandoned warehouse, and we used culvert traps on my property, foot lassos. The DNR wasn't too keen on trying to trank the bear, but because they were worried about him being treed and falling out of the tree and then having to destroy the bear. But what was amazing to me is I put out a game camera and captured pictures of this creature, and I never realized how playful bears are. He played with soccer balls in my backyard. I was never threatened by the bear. In fact, when I came home and he was back there, if he noticed me, he would usually, go to a tree.
So why did why did he have to be destroyed, Randy?
Well, I tell you what happened is he became so acclimated to the city environment and there was plenty of food for him. He was not interested in going into the culvert trap. He wasn't hungry enough. And, we asked people not to feed him, but people did anyhow. Marshfield's a city of 20,000 people, and it's hard to get them to all, do the same thing. But eventually the police felt that he was too much of a nuisance and was getting way too comfortable with the habitat, and he was treated, and they unfortunately had to shoot him. And I agree with the police. I think that he was a big bear, a very big bear.
Okay.
In fact, what we did is I asked the school if they were interested in for their animal display, a bear carcass, and the Wisconsin DNR was very generous and donated it to me, and I had it taxidermied and displayed at the school as part of our natural habitat display there.
All right. Well, thank you for that story, Randy. And David, as we wind up here, Randy did talk about one of the options that people who are opposed to the hunt have raised. Why not just, get people to close the all-you-can-eat buffet, have them secure their garbage cans, don't put the grease out where it can be gotten at by the animals. You don't think that's a good option? Why not?
No, well, I think it's a great option. I think people should do it, should try to fence their vegetable gardens to the extent that they can, understanding that deer can easily jump 6-foot fences. They should try to secure their cans if they live in an area with bears or raccoons. But the point of this is, let's suppose that with a click of our fingers, we could eliminate the access to these human food sources for all these wildlife. What would happen next? Starvation of millions of animals. And that's not necessarily a humane way of dealing with the problem either. The natural, untouched, unhuman, habitat is not large enough or sufficient to support these populations. We know that because before any humans were on this continent, or any large numbers of humans were on this continent, the natural habitat here supported much smaller populations of these animals than live here now.
David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been speaking to David Vandrili, editor-at-large for Time magazine. His article in this month's issue of Time is called America's Pest Problem. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up at 6, we're airing a one-hour documentary, Mandela, an Audio History, to celebrate the life of former South African President Nelson Mandela, who passed away earlier today. The special tells the story of his struggle against apartheid through rare sound recordings of Mandela himself and those who fought with and against him.
Now we talk about biology. Mainstream biology is based on genetic determinism, the idea that our genes hold the blueprint for who we are, how we look, and what diseases we might get.
Biology researcher Michael Skinner says there might be a little more to the story, that who we are may also be affected by the toxins our ancestors were exposed to a couple few generations ago.
Michael Skinner is a professor of biological sciences at Washington State University, and he won an American Ingenuity Award from Smithsonian Magazine for his research. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, your discovery was the result of a mistake. What happened?
Correct. Many scientific discoveries are more serendipitous, but we were studying the effects of environmental toxicants on generations to come using a rat model, and we basically got a phenotype or a trait in the first generation, and mistakenly a fellow in the lab bred that animal to make a F2 generation, which would be the great-grandchild. And lo and behold, when we looked, it had the same disease characteristics, and we took it out 4 generations and basically had this disease characteristic at very, like 90% of the animals being affected, kept appearing at that level for 4 generations to come, which suggested it was not a classic genetic phenomena.
How big a deal is this when you look at what we know and believe about DNA today?
So what we study is called epigenetics. It's the things that are around the DNA that regulate how the DNA functions. And so what we study is these sort of chemical modifications of the DNA called epigenetics. And what we've identified is a form of epigenetic inheritance. So this is a non-genetic form of inheritance that gets passed forward to all subsequent generations. And this is a totally new view of what we inherit from our parents or grandparents and so forth.
Now, you and your researchers, you focused on rats, and as I understand it, expose them to various chemicals, things like BPA, for instance, other things like that, and then saw that that had sort of changed the way the DNA was passed along. Can you explain sort of why this isn't exactly DNA we're talking about anymore?
Sure. So the DNA sequence is very important, and it followed the inheritance of that follows what's called Mendelian genetics, classic genetics. And what this is more of a chemical modification of the DNA. A small group called a methyl group gets attached to the DNA, and what we've found is that can become permanently attached. So what it is your sperm or egg that you're passing to the next generation has that in it. It'll go into the next generation, and as they make sperm and egg down the line, it'll carry that same imprint, and it'll essentially keep going from generation to generation. So truly, what your great-grandmother was exposed to in terms of a toxicant such as DDT or dioxin and so forth can change that early on in life, and you're going to pass it on to your grandkids.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So traditionally, according to what we may have thought we understood about DNA, my great-grandmother is exposed to it. It doesn't necessarily result in a mutation. So therefore, her great-grandchildren should be okay and not have that mutation. But you're saying, no, that's really not the way this is working.
That's absolutely correct. Right now, the current dogma for where disease comes from involves the idea that there's mutations in the DNA that's causing that disease. Yet when we look carefully in disease populations, very little, actually less than 1% of a population with disease actually has an identifiable mutation that can be correlated to the disease. And so this actually provides an additional mechanism, which we didn't know before, which really opens up a lot of doors for new therapeutics and diagnostics we didn't have.
Therapeutics and diagnostics. Okay, because I was thinking more along the lines of, you know, chemical companies might be liable for something that people were exposed to generations ago. What sorts of pluses are there to dealing with this?
Well, you have to remember that when the chemical companies came up with these, more than likely there was not data around to suggest that the chemicals they were using were bad. When they came up with plastics in the 1950s, they had no idea that bisphenol A was going to be harmful. It took us 20 or 30 years later we sort of found that out. So the demands that the public has is creating these products that we have in the environment. So the public needs to take responsibility for some of that. But in terms of the upside, yes, potentially in the future, we might be able to take an individual when they're 20, do a diagnostic assay for epigenetics, determine what they or their ancestors were exposed to early in life, and then what disease they're going to get later in life. And with that information, we can design therapeutic and intervention strategies to prevent the disease from developing. That's called preventative medicine. We've not really been able to do it effectively because we didn't have those early stage diagnostics.
Do you have any sense of what kind of diseases could be caused by exposure to toxins?
So we've seen everything from kidney disease, infertility in males and females, breast cancer, prostate disease, immune abnormalities, behavioral effects, obesity, essentially across the paradigm. Most of the diseases we see, metabolic syndrome, like diabetes, most of these diseases can be correlated to these epigenetic shifts.
What kind of response have you gotten about this so far?
Well, with the paradigm for genetic determinism being so predominant, it takes a lot of effort to sort of get people to change their minds. So the biggest pushback we've had is certainly initially from the drug companies and chemical industries, but also government agencies. And the scientists take a lot of convincing. So it's a slow process. Generally, these big paradigm shifts in science take a generation, and I suspect that'll be the case here as well.
Now, you've likened the way that these toxins act as a burr that sticks to the DNA. Will you be working on a way to sort of decouple it from the DNA?
So unfortunately, it's sort of like a genetic mutation where you have a base pair change in the DNA sequence. You can't really fix that. And these permanently programmed epigenetic mutations, what we call epimutations, also really won't probably be able to be fixed, at least with our current technology or anything in the near future. But like I mentioned, we can use the presence of those mutations as a diagnostic to come up for treatment. So even though, so therefore we may not be able to fix it, but we may be able to treat it in the future.
What kind of treatment are we talking about? Do you know?
So if we know, for example, that your mammary epithelial cell has a certain epigenetic signature, which is changing its function in a certain way, to then give you a susceptibility to develop breast cancer down the line, we can earlier in life, let's say in your late 20s or 30s, come up with a therapeutic to shift how that cell's functioning and prevent the disease from developing.
Hmm. Well, this discovery, as we're talking about it, has led to a whole new field. How does this change the way we think about toxins and chemicals in general in the environment around us?
Well, it certainly will give us a lot of molecular tools, which we didn't have before, to look for environmental exposures and correlate those to disease. And so that's going to be a big boom in the field of toxicology for sure. But it also suggests that many of the things that we thought were relatively safe in our environment, we need to probably be more conscientious about to remove them or at least reduce them in terms of exposures.
What kind of things are you talking about?
So probably one of the biggest exposures we have is our water source and the water we're exposed to and drink. Many of the aquifers that we pull our water from, we don't really know oftentimes the contamination levels. And so people need to be very cautious about their water. So using purified water, not only to drink, but also in their homes, is probably something they need to move towards. And there are actually things you can do about that. The other main source of contamination is more than likely your nutrition, your food intake. So what kinds of food, where they come from, and so forth, need to be considered. And, of course, if you're in occupational sort of exposure, if the people are in certain industries with occupational exposures, they need to try to reduce that, particularly when, let's say, females are pregnant. That's the most sensitive time, and so fetal development. So women that are in gestation really need to be very cautious about what they're exposed to.
So what's next for you? What epigenetic studies do you currently have underway, and how might they affect us?
So we are looking more carefully at the molecular mechanisms involved in this phenomena to gain some insights in terms of how it works. But one of our big projects is to actually take these animal studies and these epigenetic signatures we have and translate that to the human. So we have a few human studies getting started to look at cohorts of patients with certain exposures or not to see if there's epigenetic signatures we can use and make the correlations into disease they have. So that translational research is really going to be a big boom for potentially helping human health.
Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
We've been speaking to Michael Skinner, professor of biological sciences at Washington State University.
Next is the news. Then we'll be back with a look at what our guest calls a grand social experiment, mass incarceration in American prisons. Also, stick around for more coverage. Nelson Mandela has passed away. We'll have more coverage of that coming up here on Central Time. And then after 6, an NPR audio documentary on the life of Nelson Mandela. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.